I spoke to the woman upstairs there, and I wished her all luck today. And she needs it, I know. What I'm talking about today is about lie detection in terrorism settings. That is different. It's different from lie detection in police settings, and there are many differences between them. Some of the difference I would like to talk about today. One obvious difference is that in terrorist settings is quite often about lying about intentions, lying about future activities, whereas police interviews are about lying about past activities. That's a big difference also for research, and research in that area is mainly done by Per Anders Granhaak. He's the main guy in that. I will say a few words, but not too many about that. What I'm talking about are three other things. One of them is this, is undercover interviewing. And that is interviewing when the person who you interview doesn't realize it is a formal interview. And that research is done together with Shaima Juni, who was a PhD student, and Sam Mann. Shaima is now a doctor, so it's Dr. Shaima. Sam is already a doctor for decades. They're both doctors. And here they are. You can see there at the right there, the dark hair. That is Shaima, and the bottom there, the blonde hair, that is Sam. What I also will do is something about collective interviewing, and that's together with Zara. Zara Vernon, who's now a PhD student and also a research assistant with us. And this indeed is exactly the same picture, and you also can see now Zara in this picture, somewhere at the top, the blonde hair. Then I will say something about checkable detail, verifiable detail, and I do that together with Galit Nahari, who is my Israeli collaborator. And this is Galit, as you can see. Nobody has a more wonderful smile than Galit. I like that smile. But this is also Galit. And this is when she just released her latest pop album. But to be honest, this is indeed, it is Galit, but these are not her sunglasses. Undercover interviewing. When do you do that? Well, there's some reasons for doing that. And this, the first part there is what I know from talking to guys who do that. They say, okay, there are some suspects coming from Heathrow, from Pakistan or something like that, flying to the UK, and then we follow them for a few days. And we want to know whether what they do has malintentions or not. And then they say, after a few days, we have no idea. These guys have done all kinds of things, but we have no idea whether these are malintentions or not. So then we thought, what you can do is just interview those guys. But do that undercover, because they don't want to interview them, because they are afraid that will blow their cover. So interview them undercover. A second reason for doing that is that sometimes you think somebody will do something that will be harmful, but you haven't got enough information yet. And then the formal interview may be difficult to do, because too premature to have a formal interview. So in that situation, they also can do then undercover interviewing. I hope the interpreter is doing well. You just can read out the slides otherwise. It's basically the same information. Interview suspects undercover. That means you interview a suspect without the suspect being aware of the purpose of the interview. Of course, he knows he has a conversation, but he thinks it's a kind of a small chat, and not more than that. Whereas, in fact, it is an investigative interview. But of course, they need to be brief. There are some disadvantages of doing that. One is, they have to be very brief, or quite short at least. And if you do that, some of the techniques we know that work for lie detection, you cannot use in undercover interviews. For example, we know it's a very good thing to ask people to talk in reverse order, to say in reverse order what they have experienced. Well, that's a very odd question to ask of somebody just on the street. So you can't do that. But some other things you can do in formal settings, also in undercover settings. And one of them is to ask spatial questions, and I'll explain later what it is. Spatial questions are very good for lie detection. And you can ask undercover way spatial questions. But even there are some advantages. And one advantage is that you can look for differences in cooperation and forthcomingness. Because liars are less cooperative and less forthcoming. And they may be especially so if they don't know that they're interviewed. If they think they're interviewed, they may think, I need to be cooperative and I need to be forthcoming. Otherwise, it looks suspicious. If you don't know you're interviewed, you may not do that and the difference may become larger. So some studies we've done are indeed about that, are about cooperation and about forthcomingness. Briefly about intentions, but I don't say much about that. Undercover interviews can be about activities people are going to do in the future. For that, it's relevant to know what true intentions look like. And we know from research they are extremely concrete. They are very concrete if you're going to do them in the immediate future. Those intentions are far more concrete than those you're going to do a few days later, or intentions you have not really decided yet to do. It's pretty unique, and we know that from all kind of brain activity research, for example, that it is. So if you have an intention to carry out in the next, well, few hours or so, that is extremely detailed. And you can ask questions about that. What liars do, and we know they do, they don't like to be linked to all kind of information that may, of course, may make clear that they are doing, that they try to do some wrongdoing. So therefore, they probably will become less cooperative and less forthcoming in all kinds of situations and interview settings. We also know that liars prepare alibis. At least, yeah, they prepare alibis for if they got caught or ask some questions. But we also know they're not really lots of imagination in that. Many of these alibis are just are very stereotypical in what people say, or the stories are far too smooth. Truthful stories can be far more bizarre, usually, than deceptive stories are. And that is something also you can look for. And also, that's also the last point there. The alibis are very, quite often they're stereotypical. And indeed, liars do not really prepare for spatial questions. And therefore, spatial questions can work very well. This is the first study of about 10, I think, I will talk about. An interpreter was very nervous about all these slides about the methods. She may just read it out in Russian what's written there, and meanwhile I would just waffle on what also is indeed written down there. We had the terrorists and we had truth tellers. The terrorists were our own participants, and we told them what you need to go is from our city, Portsmouth, to the Isle of Wight, which is very close by, and you need to see how you can disrupt the travel to the Isle of Wight for the upcoming Isle of Wight festival. And therefore, to do that, and to say, okay, but we need to do, we look around at the hovercraft station, and the other side on the hovercraft station, what you can do to disrupt the travel. But of course, if somebody is going to ask you what to do, don't say that. Instead, what you need to do, you need to say you are a tourist who's going to travel to the Isle of Wight. And then we gave them time to prepare themselves. And we gave them a map of the Isle of Wight with all kind of information, what you could do on these kind of islands. After they prepared themselves, we brought them via the hovercraft bus, via an escort, to that hovercraft station. And there was our undercover interviewer, who now recognized them because he knew who the escort was. But of course, the participants from then on were on their own. So then he approached them and he asked them some questions. We also have, as a control group, we had their truth tellers. And these were real tourists who were going for that day to the Isle of Wight. Apparently, people go as a tourist sometimes to the Isle of Wight. At least we found, well, quite a few of them who did so. So these were the tourists. And this undercover interviewer, he interviewed them, and the whole thing, the audio taping of the whole lot, happened in a secret manner. Anyway, this is the hovercraft station. As you can see, it looks rather dodgy. But it's not because it's cheap to go in the hovercraft. In fact, it's extremely expensive to use this hovercraft. But they certainly don't use the money to make anything decent of the building. It's a pretty poor building. This is the hovercraft itself. This Portsmouth in the background is the hovercraft. As you can see, it has two engines. That is not always the case. At least once, one of the engines fell off the hovercraft. And worryingly, the crew didn't realize and didn't notice that. But in this photo, as you can see, the hovercraft has two engines. The undercover interviewer asked some questions. What he did was this. He asked them, what are you going to do on the Isle of Wight? And we're looking for stereotypical answers. And the stereotypical answer would be, I go there to visit the Osborne House, where one of those previous queens of the UK, state, I would think. Or to the Needles, as kind of some kind of rocks which are there in the Isle of Wight. There's some of those things. Or, of course, you can say, well, I'm going there to walk around the beach, or to go for lunch or something like that. These are different types of things you can do. We also asked them what time they thought they would catch the return hovercraft. thinking if you indeed have real, if you have the real intentions for doing, for example, as a tourist, you may well have more concrete information about that. You really know where you're going back, because maybe these liars won't have thought about what to say to that question. But of course, their task was just to look around at the hovercraft, at the station, and then coming back, not really stay there for a longer time. Then we also asked them, okay, whatever they said, of course, they would say they go to do some things there, and then we gave them now a blind map of the Isle of Wight. And we asked them, can you now indicate on that map where it is? So you say you go to Osborne House, on this map, where's the Osborne House? You say to go to the Needles, on this map, where are the Needles? And we also asked them, whether it's possible to make a quick snap of that person. And there was a reason for asking to do that. And we also looked at these kind of hedges, whether people say likely, probably, not sure, and so forth. The undercover interviewer was one of us, one of our guys, and he posed as a University of Portsmouth student with travel survey or as a student photographer. But no difference happened in between the two. But for both reasons, he could ask, okay, can I make a picture of you that I will put then on my website? That was one of the questions we asked. And these are the findings we have. This study is published in PPPNL. This is what we found. And we found indeed the liars, they mention more events. Indeed, going to Osborne House, going to the Needles, and so forth. The truth tellers have more activities. Having a walk there, do some shopping, go for lunch. And that's indeed something you can predict. The truth tellers are far more creative in a way than liars, who are far more stereotypical. The times mentioned, the question there was for the exact return time. Truth tellers, 80% of them, of 84%, mention exact time for coming back. Only 30% of liars do that. And based on that, you can see you get a 76% hit rate in classifying liars and truth tellers, just by asking that question. Map inaccuracy, can they indicate on the map where they're going to? Truth tellers are far more accurate. The liars on that. That's spatial information. Liars don't think about spatial information. Have not prepared themselves, and they're caught out by spatial information. Hedges, also there you see liars have the more than truth tellers. And agree to photo taken, truth tellers more than liars. And based on that, a 60% hit rate. A second study also on cooperation. So the final finding was about cooperation. The truth teller is more likely to say, yes, okay, you can take that picture of me. And we asked, by the way, also these participants at the end whether they found this odd or strange interview. And all tourists said they didn't find this very strange at all. These questions were asked. So these are questions that truth tellers pretty think is normal to be asked in settings like that. Yet you could see in the last slide, you certainly can, to some extent, distinguish liars and truth tellers by asking those questions. This is a second study. We're again looking for cooperation. And what we had here, the liars and truth tellers both go to the Guildhall Square, which is a square very close to my work, but went there for different reasons. Truth tellers to promote watching on the big screen the Olympics. Olympics were in London 2012. In the UK, all kind of big screens were put on squares so people could watch the Olympics together on that square. And they were asked, the truth tellers, okay, try to promote this square by taking some pictures of the square. The liars were told what you need to do, you need to see how you can disrupt people watching this from that square on the big screen when the Olympics are there. But of course you should never say that. So if people ask what the reason is for you walking around and taking some photographs, you need to tell the reason for you is because you want to do something to promote the square. This is that square. As you can see, it's not really a picture that would promote the square. But this is late in the year. As you can see, there are only very few leaves on the trees. This is about October, November. And this is, I'm afraid, a typical day in the UK where it is November. But you can see there in the back at least, there is that's the big square. The big screen on the square. And that's the whole thing was around that to try to promote that screen. Then we had there, we have done this. Then we had the mime artist walking around on that screen. And this is the mime artist there, the guy is called Russell. And he was walking around and he was imitating all kinds of people who were walking on that square in a kind of funny manner. Not the participants, but other people he did. And he's, by the way, walking there, indeed, he is there. Now, behind that, there's the coffee cup. And the coffee cup has very decent coffee, which is very unusual in the UK, but that is very decent coffee. In fact, it goes so far to say, come to Portsmouth just to taste the coffee. But maybe if you're in Portsmouth, go there to get some coffee because it's very good. The coffee cup is excellent. Okay, but Russell is the mime artist, and what he did, before the participants were about to leave back to his apartment, so they made all kinds of pictures, then he approached them. And he knew, because they were in a kind of a bag, he knew who the participants were. Then he approached them and he asked them whether he could have a look at the pictures they took, and saying something that he thought that maybe they took a picture of him. What we found afterwards, because indeed they took those pictures, and we could look at them, there was no difference in how many of those liars and truth tellers took a picture of him. That was not the difference. But the difference is now in cooperation. So the question was there, did you take a picture of me? And what you there can see is that more truth tellers and liars say that. Of course, not everybody will say yes. In fact, only 36% of truth tellers do so. But once a yes answer is given, it's 82% of the yes answers are correct. So a yes answer is rather discriminative in a situation like that, to see that people indeed are truth telling. And the second question then he asks, okay, can I have a look? Regardless whether they said yes or no, just I can have a look. And there you have the same. Of course, you can't have that all people say yes, but still you have that far more truth tellers and liars will say yes. So a yes answer in itself is rather rare, but if the yes answer is given, it's quite likely that it's a truthful answer. So two studies showing that indeed truth tellers are more cooperative than liars are. And of course you can think about many other ways in which you try to kind of elicit difference of cooperation between the two via undercover interviewing. You can also use it for something else. We did two studies on that, whether you can establish evidence through undercover interviewing. And here it goes as follows. And it has to do with the fact indeed that liars may be less forthcoming. So what you do now, you interview a suspect first undercover. So you shadow a suspect, whatever you do, you interview that guy undercover. And then you interview the guy again later on. And you ask about what he did. And that's either an undercover or not, it doesn't matter what it is. But then the second interviewer knows that the first interview took place. And now you just see whether that guy indeed will mention the first interview or not. And now you can predict if indeed our liars are less forthcoming, they are less likely to mention that first interview. And that means if they don't mention the first interview, that may look suspicious. That's the idea about this, about establishing evidence through undercover interviewing. So this is a study in which we had participants going on a mission. Truth tellers and liars went on different missions. The truth tellers went on a mission to promote a park very close to our work. A liar went on a mission, a kind of animal rights type of mission, by all kind of companies using animal fur, to be against that. These were different missions, but it had one overlap. And the overlap was that both liars and truth tellers went into the park to an animal enclosure, where rabbits are. And they were asked to take a picture of that rabbit. So liars and truth tellers both did that. Liars were told, if anyone asks you anything you do, what you need to do, of course, don't say that you're going to for this animal rights campaign, say that you're there to promote the park. And there exactly when they took the picture, they were now interviewed by an undercover interviewer, one of us, who asked them some questions. And asked the questions of, okay, what are you doing here now? Well, of course, they were taking pictures of the rabbits. And what do you think of the park? And these kind of, well, pretty harmless questions were asked. And what we did now is just to see whether these participants indeed will mention that interaction or not. So after that mission, they were now came back to the department and they were formally interviewed. And there they were asked, okay, what did you do in the last hour or so? And just listen whether they indeed mentioned that undercover interview or not. And then there's a first question that, so tell me in as much detail as possible what you did this afternoon during the mission and listening to that undercover interview. But then something like describe everything you could see from the rabbit enclosure. Well, there they certainly could see that guy. And some more questions about the undercover stuff. Is there anyone who could confirm you were at the rabbit enclosure? But that also needs to be the guy who indeed interviewed them. And then we had that everybody minus one person mentioned eventually that indeed there was another interviewer. And then we asked, okay, what did the person ask you? And just we looked indeed for answer. We looked first for the answer in the open-ended question. What did you do the afternoon? How many people now mention that they are interviewed by that undercover interviewer? And as you can see, the truth tellers 44% do, and the liars only 9. 9 is very low, 44 is higher. That's a difference indeed, and it gives you about a hit rate of about 70-something percent you get. But as you can see, also truth tellers don't mention that guy. Because that guy is, of course, not part of their mission. Their mission is to take pictures to promote the park, and that silly guy asks them some questions is completely irrelevant for their own mission. So therefore, also truth tellers will not really mention the guy. But it certainly is a difference. in a situation like that. And then we ask more of those questions about that, and then you see that throughout the interview, indeed, the truth tellers, more than the liars, will mention they are interviewed by that undercover interviewer. And then at the end we ask, because everybody minus one said the interview took place, then we said, okay, what did the guy ask? And of course we knew exactly what he asked. And there you can see that truth tellers, more than liars, are likely to say indeed the questions he asked. So that means you can establish the evidence by doing something that you know that happened, and what kind of mission the person had. You know something happened, you ask about it, and you see, because liars are less forthcoming, that they're less likely to give information about that. You can also do that in a second way, and this is comes very close to when I spoke to these intelligence officers that came up with the whole idea about undercover interviewing, what happened about 4 or 5 years ago, about the fact that they said, okay, we follow all these guys, they do all kind of activities, how on earth can we know that what they do are malintentions or not? And this is a study which we try to replicate that. So here we have now indeed something, an admission happened, and we knew exactly what happened, and now you can see how often, how many of those activities are now mentioned by both the liars and by the truth tellers. This is an extremely complicated mission, the most difficult we did. And I don't say much about those missions, but I can really, trust me, this is very hard to do those. It's quite interesting and nice to design those. It's a complete nightmare to carry them out. And credits to Sam and Shaman for being able to complete all those studies, because really this is tough work to do. Okay, so they have there all kind of activities happened in that mission, and these kind of things will happen. So if somebody would follow that person, he would see that he would be approached by a street cleaner, so that the participants went on a mission out of our department. The truth tellers did so because they would ask, okay, you need to organize a surprise party for a friend, and you need to do all kind of things. And that includes, for example, you want to sleep somewhere in the park at night. Liars were told, but you need to do a walk around the city in a certain way, and you need to see where you can put a decoy device to disrupt all kind of things there in Portsmouth. But if that is not, if somebody asks you what you're going to do, say now that you did what the truth tellers were going to do, indeed to organize that party for the friend. But both liars and truth tellers had exactly the same mission. And this is, in my view, the first study ever in that area. Exactly the same things they did, only for different reasons. The liars did that in their mind, at least, to think to put a decoy device, the truth tellers to organize a party with a friend. But activities were utterly and completely identical. So what happened there? They were approached by they approached a street cleaner, and if you would follow the person, you could see that. They received a phone call, because we phoned them. They checked some doors, whether they were open. They were approached by someone conducting a survey. They received a phone call from the train, because we phoned them when they were on the train. And they received a phone call at the train station. So if you just follow these people, these are the six things that you see that will happen in that situation. And now when we interviewed them, the question was, okay, tell me in as detail as possible what happened. And we coded the detail they gave, just a number of units of information they gave, but we also coded how many of those observable evidence they gave, the things that we know a officer who's shadowing them would see. And this is what we found. Remember, it were exactly the same activities. Yet, as you can see, truth tellers give you far more detail about it than liars. 72 units of information versus 41. And that's 65% hit rate you have, classifying liars and truth tellers correctly just by listening to detail. We also found, looking for that evidence, 6 points of evidence, the truth tellers give you more of those points than liars do. 71% hit rate you will get over there. So you can see the liars, although they did exactly the same as the truth tellers, give you less information. And why did they do that? Well, we asked them some questions afterwards in a questionnaire. And one of the questions was, indeed, whether they told everything they remembered. And they said no. Liars said more than truth tellers, they didn't. So they left some information out on purpose. And then we asked, why did you do that? And they say then, because we think what we did otherwise looks suspicious. Exactly the same activities as truth tellers. Truth tellers do that and don't think suspicious. Liars, when they do that, think it is suspicious. Because liars think that the truth will shine through, and all kinds of things they do may look suspicious. Whereas they're not for truth tellers. So therefore we see again that liars are less forthcoming than truth tellers in those situations. I think I got about 60 something slides, and now on number 37. So for an interpreter, you're well over halfway in this impossible exercise. So the conclusion there of undercover interviewing is that indeed you certainly can distinguish to some extent liars from truth tellers for the very simple reason that liars are less cooperative and less forthcoming. And if you realize that, you can do all sorts of things that will trigger the difference between liars and truth tellers in that aspect. And of course, we've done 3 or 4 studies, you can do far more. If you start thinking about that, there's many more things you can do in this area in order to elicit further differences. But look for cooperation, look for forthcomingness, but these are, because that's where the differences lie between the two groups. Collective interviewing. This is interviewing suspects together. That is something that the police rarely does, because they have sometimes indeed their suspects they have together. They think that, for example, suspects in a group committed some crimes. What they then do, they always separate them and they ask them the same questions in 2 different rooms. Well, we know if you ask the right questions, it's pretty good for lie detection. You need to ask the right questions, but indeed you can do something there that you now can distinguish rather well who's lying or not. But sometimes it may be easier just to interview those guys together. And it may be easier in all kinds of situations. For example, border checkpoints. If people travel together, if people are in the car, it's far easier. Just ask one question to these guys in the car, rather than getting all out of the car and ask it separately. And of course, if you need to ask all these guys these questions separately, you need more of those interviewers. Border checkpoints is a good point for that, but other situations as well. All kinds of streetwise things, groups of youth walking somewhere, you just can have one question to the whole group entirely rather than having all these people separately. Either you need more interviewers or you need more time. So it's effective to interview those guys collectively. It has certainly a potential benefit, because what you now can look at is the communication between the liars or the truth tellers. Of course, if you only have one interviewee, you only have the communication between that interviewee and the interviewer. If you have 2 or more interviewees, you now have the communication between those interviewees and the interviewer, but also between those interviewees. And in this research, we're especially interested in the communication between those interviewees. And that's what we do in these collective interviews. So now you interview those guys together. And we know if you go to research, but it's not so much deception research, but basic memory research, we know if people have shared experiences of activities, what they then do, and you ask about that, they will communicate to each other. If people have jointly experienced an event and you ask them what happened, they start communicating. One person starts, the other will interrupt, the other will add, the other will correct. Those guys start talking together. We know that from research outside deception research, that's a very basic thing in human nature to do. But what would liars do? Liars may prepare what to say as answer. What you then may well have is that the liar, indeed one liar, gives that answer and the other one has nothing to add. Because they just have told beforehand, have just agreed beforehand what they would say. There's nothing to add. Or it may be that you ask a question that none of these liars have expected. What will happen then? The likelihood there is that one person will say something and the other will just agree with that. Because why would you make your life more difficult by then interrupting the person or correcting the person? Certainly if you start correcting somebody else, it may now sound that what you said wasn't true. It may sound as suspicious if you now start correcting each other. So you therefore can predict that liars will be far less communicative. They won't interact as much. And they just will give one answer and the other person will just nod his head. So that's what we are looking for in a study like this. This is our restaurant study, in which we had truth tellers really going to a restaurant together for about an hour. Liars didn't go there, did something else. And the liars were told, okay, what you need to say, need to pretend, is that you had lunch together for that hour. And then they were interviewed indeed about that. And before they went to the interview, we now asked them, we told them, okay, prepare yourself for possible questions in a situation like that. Truth tellers are friends, liars are friends, and these students, they mostly are students, of course they know all kinds of places around Portsmouth where you can have lunch, so they could certainly talk about that. In fact, they went them here. This is Gun Wharf. This is close to our work, and these are it's about 200 meters from where we are. And students quite often go there. And in fact, this is one of the places where recently celebrated the 25th anniversary of Sam's PhD doctorship. So that's a very good place. She's a very good memory for this particular restaurant over there, because we had a great night over there. Okay, so what happened there? We have there and we just look for the interaction that happens between these liars and these truth tellers. And we're looking for interruptions, corrections, adding information. And what we found, you see that far more in truth tellers and liars. Truth tellers communicate. They do interrupt each other, they do correct each other, they do add information to each other. And the hit rates, it's well in the 70% you get over there. Now the interesting thing is, you even don't have to listen to what they're talking about. You just look at interactions. So maybe at an airport setting or something like that, if you don't know, if people speak a language you're not very good at, it doesn't matter anymore. You just see whether these guys interact. But you also see is that the truth tellers look more at each other and the liars more at the interviewer. The reason for that is if you start talking to somebody else, you start looking at the other person. That's what you do. So what liars do, that looks very odd. They don't interact, they just sit there and look at you. And I think, I don't know, but that's some of the studies we go to design over the summer, is maybe, because the difference is rather big, maybe if you just even don't hear them anymore, maybe just via CCTV cameras, you already can see what's going on there. You just can see whether there's communication going on or not. If there's communication going on, it's more likely to be truthful. You can see there's about in the 70% hit rate you get in a situation like that. So when do you use collective interviewing? Maybe not in the police, so the police can also use that in door-to-door investigations. But maybe not so much police, maybe other situations certainly. Border cross points are good, groups of youth are good, I've both mentioned them. But also maybe to obtain a passport in a country. At least it happens in the UK. In the UK, it still is, an EU country. It may change in 2 years' time, but now they still are EU country. And some people want to a new non-EU citizen wants to get an EU passport. And one way of doing that is to marry somebody with an EU passport, because then also you get one. So you have all kind of sham marriages going on, because there's a market in that. So what you now have, some people can who has an EU passport, now marry somebody else and gets money for doing that. That's happening in the UK. We don't know how often that happens, but it happens. So we certainly know that happens. And so therefore now they try to figure out indeed whether these are sham marriages or not, and now they do interview people. And these interviews, a part of that is a collective interview, in which they now have the couple together and interview about whatever they do. But we tried, because we spoke to these people beforehand, but we asked them what they ask in the interviews, they told me, we're not telling you that, that's confidential information. But we know that they do those interviews. So we set up an interview setting like that. And we had now our own interview protocol. And we did something we called forced turn taking. So what we try to do now is to make that interview setting even more difficult for liars than for truth tellers. And we did it via forced turn taking. Forced turn taking means that one person starts answering a question and then say 15 to 20 seconds later, you interrupt that person and now say to the other person, and now you continue with this story. And then 20 seconds later, you interrupt him and say, and now you continue with that. That, of course, you can imagine. That's for truth tellers maybe a doable thing to do. But how difficult is this going to get for liars? Certain liars have not expected the question. One person gives now the answer. And remember, I said what happens before. The other liars tend to just nod ahead, indeed, this happened. If you now say, and now you continue, this guy now has to continue with the story in a kind of plausible way. That, you can imagine, is quite a difficult thing to do. So what we have now in our study, we had truth tellers and liars, they were pairs. And the truth tellers were real couples, and they lived together for 1 year at least. The liars were friends of each other, and to pretend to be in a relationship together. That is not really reflecting real life. In real life, it's very often they're strangers to each other. Here they're not, they're friends of each other. So in fact, it made the liars easier than real life will be. And then they came to our lab, said, okay, we're going to talk to you about your relationship, either the real one or of course the pretended one. And we now gave them some topics to prepare about. We said to them beforehand, okay, what are you going to do? We're going to ask you questions about how you met, how you spent time together, and where you live. We didn't tell them exactly the questions, but we gave them the topics. And we sent them out for half an hour, three quarters of an hour, gave them money for the coffee, prepare yourself for this. Of course, in real life, not the case. In real life, these guys are not friends of each other, no idea what would be asked. So we made the liars easier than it would be in real life. And then we interviewed them and indeed asked some of those questions. We asked 6 questions, and they covered these topics. So describe in as much detail as possible how you first met. Describe your recent memorable day that you spent together hour by hour. And it can't be your wedding day. So all kind of questions, they didn't know the question, but knew the topic we were talking about. And then we introduced, or not, in 3 of those questions, we introduced turn-taking, not in the other ones. We first look at the turn-taking questions, but certainly also we look at what kind of cues we're looking for. First is waiting. How long does it take before the second person, after the first person start answering, he's interrupted, how long does it take before the second person starts talking? Once he starts talking, what does he do? Is he now repeating what the first person said, or is he really continuing? And what we were expecting that will happen is the liar, because the task is difficult, they will wait longer before they start answering. And once they start answering, what will they do? We are thinking they are more likely to repeat what they've said rather than to continue the information. So 3 cues we were looking at. This paper is also in PPPNL, that's Psychology, Public Policy and Law. And this is what we found. The number of pauses, indeed the liars pause longer than the truth tellers. And look at the hit rate, 83%. The number of repeats, liars, once they start talking, repeat themselves more than truth tellers. Look at the hit rate, 84%. And the number of continuations, truth tellers do that more than liars, with a slightly lower hit rate. But some, and the combination between waiting and repeating is quite interesting. What is probably going on, kind of impression management. One liar starts answering the question. The other person has no idea what to say. The guy is interrupted. Now he needs to continue. He doesn't know what to say yet. Then he starts thinking, I can't wait here forever, because that looks suspicious. I need to say something. I don't know what to say yet. What's the way out? You just repeat what the other person has said, and then you continue. As you can see, these are rather strong findings in a situation like that. What we then had, we had a lie detection study, in which we had now 90, we had 90 people doing in that study, we had now 90 of these transcripts. And we showed them to, we let observers read those transcripts. And they either read the transcripts of non-turn-taking questions, because they also were there, non-turn-taking, and they were asked just look for detail. Or in the second group, they looked at those turn-taking questions, and again, when it's a kind of control condition, asked, okay, look for detail. Or now they read the turn-taking questions, the 3, and were asked to look for those turn-taking cues we had. And these were pauses, continuations, and repetitions, those 3. And these are the hit rates we found. These are blind observers, just have one, not the whole set of, but just one transcript they read. Is the person lying? Is the person telling the truth? 77%. One of the highest hit rates in lie detection research so far in this, well, in general, and certainly for this collective interviewing. Remember, we made the liars, in fact, easier. They were friends of each other. They knew the topic they would talk about. Yet you get this. I'm absolutely convinced if the UK starts introducing forced turn-taking in the interview setting, that they will get better in trying to distinguish the sham marriages or not. So collective interviewing, I'm now almost in 2/3 of my talk. I have no idea what time it is because there's no clock and I have no watch, but I'm 2/3 of my talk. Collective interviewing leads to diagnostic communication cues to deceit. And you get more interaction between truth tellers than between liars, and liars have difficulty with that forced turn-taking. The third part that we'll talk about is not really lie detection in intelligence settings. Well, it certainly is, but you also can use that in other kind of settings. And that's our checkable detail research. And I do that together with Khalid. And I think this is highly promising research. I think, in fact, it's excellent. And well, I can say it's excellent because I'm not the brains behind this. Khalid is the driving force of this research, but I think it's something very interesting in this type of work. What do we have so far in the verbal cues to deception? There are 2 different techniques around. One is called criteria-based content analysis, and maybe people know about that. That, I think, that technique certainly works if you interview children. I don't know of any kind of technique that's better than CBCA if you interview children. But if you interview adults, I have problems with it. For some time, I doubt that it really works so well. I'm not really convinced about the theory behind CBCA, but I also think it's far too complicated. CBCA is very difficult. All kind of 90 criteria, and some of them really are not really easy to distinguish from themselves. Many of them do not really occur very often. I really think the method is far too difficult to try to use for statements of adults. So therefore, a long time I start thinking, what else can you do? And then, of course, RM, rate monitoring, came on the market, which I think is better. It's better because it's memory, at least for adults, not talking about children, for adults. For adults, I think it's better because it's memory-based lie detection. And therefore, it's more theoretical based and based on memory. And that is good because deception has a lot to do with memory. So it has a stronger theoretical foundation than CBCA. And it is far and far easier to use. And and the hit rates type, it's almost the same. If you use an adult statement, both get to 70%. And if you, like me and our researchers, do both kind of methods, you understand why you almost get the same hit rates. Because it is a far easier way, the RM, but certainly it doesn't leave information out that you code with CBCA. So you code almost the same units of information in a far easier way. But now our checkable detail part, I think it's far superior to any of those, at least for adult statements, for some reasons. First is, it's based on strategies. It's based on strategies that liars and truth tellers use. And I like strategy-based research. I like the Sue technique for Paranders, for example. It's strategy-based research. And it's good because if you know the strategies liars and truth tellers use, and if they use different strategies, you now can, via interview protocols, really get the difference larger between the two groups because you tackle on the different strategies they use. So therefore, I think strategy-based research is, for lie detection, the most promising type of research. Sue is strategy-based. This is also strategy-based. It is very easy to use, and I'll give an example how to use that. It can be used as a within subjects tool, which also is very handy to use in a situation like that. CBCA-RM is always between. You don't have a cut-off score. It's impossible to get a cut-off score for CBCA or for RM. It is possible for the checkable detail research. And also, it is far more resistant to countermeasures. We know if you tell people how CBCA works, how RM works, if you tell adults how it works, it doesn't work anymore. Because adults can now lie in a certain way that makes them convincing for CBCA experts, for RM experts. It's a big problem. If people come to know how the system works, system doesn't work anymore. That's called countermeasures. It's a big problem in general on lie detection research. It's also a big problem in verbal lie detection research. And I think, and we show some data, we'll show you now, that this approach is far more resistant against countermeasures. What's all behind? And that's where Galit came in, because Galit, again, is the brains behind this. And she found this, we did research in Israel, some other things we did, about strategies people use. That's quite interesting, just to ask liars and truth tellers what's going on in your mind. And that's for the last, say, 10 years people do research on that. Before that, they never did. These researchers assumed they knew what was going on, rather asking questions about that. And only since the Paolo article 2003 in Psychological Bulletin, researchers now start more doing strategies research and just trying to see what's going on in the mind of liars and truth tellers in all kinds of settings. And there we found that indeed the basis behind this is what liars try to do. Liars like to be detailed. They like to be detailed because they know if I give details, that sounds convincing. And it works like that. If you give more detail, people are more likely to believe you. So being detailed helps for a liar. But the liar is afraid of giving too much detail because he's afraid that you now can check the detail he gives. And then you know that they are lying. And what's the solution to that? The solution is to give detail you cannot check. And that's what we found in the Galit study in Israel, that some of those liars wrote down, that's our strategy. And that made us think, okay, let's do research on this. So what you now can think of, just look at the detail people give. And the question is now, can you in principle check this detail? And that's the study, that's the basic idea behind this. So we had in the first study here a mission study. And truth tellers went out for 30 minutes to do whatever they wanted to do. Liars did something else. They had to steal an exam paper and to photocopy that. But they had to say, of course, to hide that and say that they did something else. What we then did, we asked those liars and truth tellers to write down in the statement what they've done in the last 30 minutes. And we're looking for verifiable detail, for checkable detail. Details you in principle can check. If people made a phone call, you can check. If people said we interacted with another person, you can check. So just look for checkable detail. That's what we did. And this is what we found. And we looked at the ratio. between verifiable and unverifiable details. So we made it within subject design. And we found an exit rate of 72%. That's the same almost you get with CBCA and RM. It's a very easy tool to use. So we found indeed the truth teller gives you more detail you can check. But now the method goes one step further. And now I think it becomes even, now it becomes really exciting what we do. And that is this. What we now did in the study, we told now our participants exactly the same mission as we had. But now we said to our participants, okay, before you start writing down what you did, try to include detail we can check. So we now told these participants exactly what we do. Help us out. Give us detail we can check. That's a vital element of this of this approach. And what did we find? We found this. If you have here in the left, that is the normal condition, the non-primed. And you see indeed the truth tellers give you more checkable detail than liars. But now you tell them. You tell them, give us information you can check. The truth tellers, that's a very high score, 18 now, compared to 8. The difference gets much larger. The truth tellers now is trying to think with you. What can I do to show my innocence? Of course, liars are completely stuck. And this is because it's good, because it's strategy-based research. What you do, you know exactly what the liars can't do. They can't give you information you can check. If you now tell you, they'll tell the truth tellers. You're looking for that, the effect is getting larger. And we do this research, well, yeah, for a few years, but other things we do is quite often talk to all kinds of practitioners, mostly intelligence officers, sometimes police as well. And the checkable detail, they say, we do that all the time. And I think they're right, in a way. But they do this condition. So what practitioners do, they listen to the answers and think, can I check that detail? The interesting thing is, researchers have never done this. Practitioners already for decades, that's what they do. They just think, can I check the detail? There's a good example that you certainly can listen and can learn a lot from practitioners. Because we researchers only do CBCA and RM, not a single police officer who does CBCA and RM. It's far too difficult. They just use this method. Can I check the information or not? And you can check information, they immediately do. In intelligence settings, you quite often have an interviewer and a guy who analyzes all kind of information, who listens with it and immediately start checking the information you give. That happens in real life. But what we do is an essential difference. What we do, we say to these participants beforehand, before you start talking, try to include information we can check. That is new in it, and that's what practitioners not do. So that's where you get this. So you get a far larger difference if you tell that. It's a crucial element of this approach, and now it really becomes far better. So therefore you see indeed, but you always have to said it before, if you tell people what you're looking for, it always screws everything up. You get the countermeasures. If you tell people how CBCA works, how RM works, it's over. Because liars now easily can include all sorts of details that now for the CBCA expert sounds extremely plausible, whereas in fact they're lying. This method makes matters better. It helps the investigator to tell what you do. What is better for lie detection? If you tell people what you do, it makes the method stronger. It's the first method that I'm aware of that indeed works like this. The polygraph, the nightmare for all these polygraph examiners, that people now start using the internet to see how the system works. Of course, a lot of things going on, just you fool your subjects. If they know the way it works, it's far more difficult to use. This method still works if you tell people how it works. I think this is the final study I will say. Again, I have no idea what time I was about to do, but I know that I'm getting towards the end of my talk. That is this. This is we know from research, we know from looking into data, that if people have alibis, that very often, 75% of that, it includes another witness. So the most plausible alibi people use is, okay, I didn't do the crime because I was with somebody else that day, something like that. That happened also in the Ian Huntley Maxime Carr case. And if you're not from UK, you don't know who Ian Huntley is, you don't know who Maxime Carr is. It doesn't matter. Ian Huntley is a criminal, and he's convicted for that. Maxime Carr was his girlfriend. And he was initially a suspect. But he said, no, I have not committed the crime because I was with Maxime Carr, my girlfriend, all day. And so they interviewed Maxime Carr and she confirmed indeed we were together all day. So he had an alibi. The alibi was his girlfriend. Then he was a suspect of, but then they couldn't find the real criminal, and a kind of breakthrough was there, and then they realized that indeed Ian Huntley had committed the crime. Then they also realized that Maxime Carr has been lying, because she was not with him, she was somewhere else. But Maxime Carr backed him up because she really thought he was innocent and thought, I can easier tell the police that I was together with him because then he won't be a suspect anymore. We know from research that 60 to 80% of the Maxime Carrs are willing to do this. 60 to 80% of partners are willing to help out their partner if asked to do so. So the fact that Ian Huntley asked Maxime Carr to help him out is not unusual. The fact that Maxime Carr was willing to do that is not unusual. We also know that 60% of the Maxime Carrs think it's easy to do. They think it's easy to say that we were together, although we were not together. But this method makes it now very hard. Because what you do now, you say, okay, you say you were together, and now the method is prove that you were together. Whatever you say, it doesn't matter, but demonstrate that indeed you did this together. That's the vital part of the method now. So now we had a mission study. Another one. We had truth tellers, they did all kinds of activities together. The liars are separated. One person did all those truth tellers activities. The liar did something else. But the liar was told what you need to do, that pair was told, okay, just say you did this together. So they did. The truth tellers did it really together. The liar, one individual, did that, and the other person not. But you have to pretend you did this together. They were asked to write a statement, what they did, and they were told beforehand, try to include information that shows you did this together. And this is what we found. We found the truth tellers, 39 of those details, indeed they were together, liars, 13. And the hit rate, it's 86, 88% is the hit rate in a study like that. It is pretty easy to do. And of course, the interesting thing is, those 13 details liars give, that's bluffing. Because they didn't do that together. And what happens in real life, you can straight away. You can try to check, and you see they are lying. So probably in real life, situation may even be lower than it is here. 88% is extremely high. And remember the Ian Huntley Maxime Carr case was a very important case there in the UK, well, say 5, 6, 7 years ago. I really believe that this method makes lies far easier to discover in those kind of settings that people initially thought, because they found it very hard. Because they found, they thought Maxime Carr was so extremely detailed in telling what they did together. But they never asked the question, okay, demonstrate that all the things you did together. And that's, I think, the way forward in verbal lie detection. I have no idea what time is, but I know this was the last slide. Thank you very much for interpreting this. Excellent. Thank you very much. And thank you very much for listening.